Good afternoon. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change here in the Dawnland. We explore topics such as restorative justice, restorative practices, decolonization, cultural revival, and more. Our guests are people involved in aspects of truth, healing, and change work. This program is offered in an effort to share, inspire, and inform. Dawnland Signals is a collaboration of Wabanaki Reach and WERU-FM.
Good afternoon. My name is Esther Ann, co-host of Dawnland Signals. Today we are talking about a return to the teachings again. We have been exploring this topic with elders from our Wabanaki communities. And we originally arrived at this topic after thinking about our particular New Year's tradition, the New Year's forgiveness ceremony. And we really wanted to make sure that we remember and state with certainty that these values still exist. The customs and rituals that are embedded in Wabanaki culture are based on our core relational values, how we nurture our relationships and take care of one another and the world around us. So we want to make sure to lift these values up and acknowledge the inherent goodness of Wabanaki people. So we're really pleased to be able to continue these discussions around a return to the teachings. But before we introduce our special guest today, Maria will start us off with an appreciation for the land.
Thanks, Esther. Yes, before we introduce our special guest, let's just take a moment to acknowledge the land beneath our feet. Wabanaki, the land of the first light, the dawn land. Land that has known Wabanaki ancestors, the tallest trees, and the oldest rivers. Land that has known peace and conflict. Land that has nourished us and sustained us since time immemorial. We acknowledge the indigenous peoples of this land, Wabanakiig, the Passamaquoddy, Penobscot, Mi'kmaq, Maliseet, and Abenaki, and we give thanks to your stewardship and resilience. We are broadcasting from WERU Studio in Blue Hill, Alamoosuc, Wabanakiig.
Thank you, Maria. Today on Dawnland Signals, we are again talking about a return to the teachings and uplifting Wabanaki values, and so excited to have sort of a guest that some would say needs no introduction. our guest today is John Dennis. He's a cultural coordinator for the Rustic Band of Mi'kmaqs, and we share a lot in common, like we like puns. He's the pun master. Hi, John. I'm so glad you could be here today.
Oh, yes. It's nice to be here. It's nice to hear you guys' voices as well.
So we have so much to talk about. And I know it always seems like an hour show is going to take a long time, but we really do run out of time. And at the end, we don't want the discussion to stop. So we'll just get right into it. You're the cultural coordinator at the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaqs, but your work in preserving Mi'kmaq language and culture has been a lot longer since you've been in that position, right? How long have you been involved in this work or this play, this fund?
I guess I would say I've been involved in preserving the language for, a little more than 10 years, I guess. Because I started this position as a cultural director at that time in 2009. But before that, I was still doing some lessons here and there around with the Head Start and with Boys and Girls Club. And some people, of course, you get the generic, how do you say this and how do you say that? You know, how do you say dolphin? How do you say white foot or white paws, because that's what people call their names or their pets' names. So Wabigut, you get the average ones, Moo-in, you know, you get so many of the same same names for pets, you know, and it's just so funny after a while that you kind of just know exactly by looking at the dog what kind of name it already has. Because some bit scraggly looking and all, it's probably called Bear. If it's got white feet, it's probably called Wubbegut or something like that. White feet, you know, and it's just, you know, some are just very basic, Ulmooj. And then there's some, you know, native, we have humor. So took me a long time to get it, but there was one called D-O-G. And, you know, and it took me a while to really get it. And it's like, why did you call him that? Because that's how you spell it, D-O-G. And so, yeah. And so the names are really funny when it comes to that. And it's like, that's why I love going and teaching a language, because there is so much humor. There's so much that's intertwined with the language. You know, I learned so much about the history. I learned so much about our spirit, you know, our spirituality and, you know, who we are and where we come from and all this. It's, you know, when they say it's in the language, it is really embedded in the language. I mean, it's just, it's phenomenal how much I learned. And English is my second language, you know, because I grew up, Sesame Street helped me out a lot, really, with learning when I was a kid and watching it. And because we didn't really, growing up in Escazoni, up in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, we really did not have many English-speaking people on the reservation, but one of my friends was. And so I had to learn English. And, you know, in Canada, you learn English and French, but I don't know French, you know. I wasn't really interested in it. But, you know, when it came to that, now I'm looking back at where I'm at now. My mom, she lives with me. So, you know, we speak Mi'kmaq almost on a daily basis, you know. And when I come to work, one of my coworkers, he speaks Mi'kmaq with me all the time. So we're always conversing in that manner, you know. So, and in teaching, you know, I've been teaching the language with the kids, the Head Start kids, and now, you know, and with the Boys and Girls Club or youth, and now these kids, their parents, you know, it's funny to see it in that manner. And, you know, and when you see the kids that you were teaching, and now when you look, who's your mom? Oh, this is my mom. It's like, oh, I remember you know, and it's like, then you start thinking, man, I'm getting old. You start thinking about all those years that have gone by, and then it's like, oh wow, you know, I've been doing this for a long time. And in preserving even like the culture, you know, talking about preserving the culture, it's just there's so many facets or so many ways of just preserving it. Storytelling, dancing, singing, you know, I try to incorporate as much as possible. We just started doing workshops, cultural workshops. So we've been working with Hyde since January on a 2-week basis, and we're still working on it because it is such a long process. We'll transition from that to going to working with Moosehide, and then or Hyde itself for the drums, and then we'll work with Leather.
Wow, I'm glad I had it on mute because I was laughing so hard. You probably wouldn't have been able to hear you talk. That D-O-G, it's a good thing I didn't spit out my water here. That was funny.
I was just taken by what you were saying about there's so many ways to preserve the culture, singing and doing activities the same as our ancestors had. And through my language learning journey here at Penobscot, I always remember Carol Dana, our Penobscot language teacher, and how she's always saying, you got to learn with your hands and as you're doing things, and that's a better way to learn as opposed to, you know, sitting in the classroom and taking notes when you're actively involved in doing those activities.
Mm-hmm.
Because our language is mostly action-based, isn't it? More verbs than nouns.
Yeah. And we use our lips quite a bit, and especially when we're pointing. With these masks on, it's so hard to get directions.
I was told that we all had the habit of pointing with our lips because our hands were always busy doing something. So I could just imagine, like, you know, cleaning the cedar or weaving the sweet grass or weaving the basket. You know, our hands are always occupied.
Yes. Yeah. Busy hands. That's for sure. I remember growing up and seeing, like, my grandfather working with, you know, so many different, like, making baskets and even, like, making what we call the it's like a tambourine, I guess, but it's made of ash splints, and it's just one piece of wood. It's called jigamahan. It goes chick-chick-chick. So it has that song, mahan, because it's made of wood. So it sounds like jig, but it's made of wood, so jigamahan. It's just funny how that word combines.
And that's used, it's a musical instrument, John. I'm not sure if I remember, I'm familiar with that. It's just a round piece of
it's just the ash that's cut in small pieces, and then one end is just pounded and the other end is still intact.
And so it's like flapping.
Like a clapper, yeah. But they call it jigbahan because it makes that sound. So you can sing many songs with it. And it's, you can go fast as well. So you can sing those. So a long time ago, what I've heard anyway was that what they used to do a long time ago, they were prohibited from practicing their culture. So if they were singing, they would have to, you know, they would have to hide it. With the jigamahan, you can just throw it in the fire and really didn't have to worry about it because it was wood that that you didn't really use. It was just leftover wood. So instead of just throwing it away, you'd make a jigamahan out of it. So it was easy.
Wow. I like that story.
Yeah. But it just...
Me too.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, me too. It made me think of, you know, it, like the resilience of our ancestors, you know, being prohibited from practicing our culture, but we're going to practice it anyway.
Yeah.
Going to outfox
exactly.
You.
I mean, for me, it's like when I hear about that, you hear about how they made it, what it was for, and if, for example, if they were to be caught, they would know what exactly to do and, you know, and the times were different from where they're at now.
Go ahead, Maria. No, you go, Dus.
I just was curious why he's talking about, you know, being prohibited from practicing culture and times are different from what they are now. I didn't know if he wanted to expand on that any.
Yeah, we were like a long time ago. This was when the Indian Asians were on the reservations. They were people like, you know, our people were prohibited from practicing our culture. So even like something as simple as singing songs was prohibited. I mean, they would be, you know, either have their rations cut or be placed in jail or something, or something where some kind of punishment. And so during that era, it was just very difficult for us to maintain our culture. Whereas today, we maintain our culture. I mean, we're having virtual powwows, we're having virtual socials. So we're not really, we can drum and do whatever that we want nowadays, you know, but as long as it's done in a respectful manner. That's the only thing I guess that most elders would say.
You know, I was surprised to learn as an adult that it wasn't until 1978 that in the United States, Native American people were given religious freedom. So up until 1978, that, you know, those prohibitions, even though we might not have had an Indian agent that whole time, that it was still prohibited legally.
Yeah. 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 The Indian agents kind of went away a while back, but still, yeah, we didn't have that, that freedom of right or whatever, you know, that religion aspect of it. And, you know, and that's just it. I guess I try to emulate that to the kids, this generation, so that way they kind of understand why it's so important for us to have this. You know, not a lot of people really know.
Yeah, and now there's also a protocol for the Fish and Wildlife, maybe to gift eagle feathers to Native people, right?
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that?
Not exactly. And that's the first I've ever heard of it. And I think I know that whenever somebody finds an eagle feather, they contact us. And then, you know, for me, I just take them. And then after that, we have a recovery center here, or recovery meetings and all this. So after a certain time, when a person celebrates their 1 year or whatever, I gift them that eagle feather. So because 1 year is a long time.
It is.
Even that's 6 months.
A gift.
Yeah. And it's a nice start to making their own bundle as well. You know, their sacred bundle. But yeah, I think it's important really that this generation really knows, you know, it's funny because I'm 46 and I'm, you know, and all these people would say, oh, you're not that old, but I'm still old enough to remember a lot of things in the 70s and all this. So, and there's so much. I mean, I remember growing up and, you know, it wasn't until I was a teenager that the powwow started coming and nobody knew what that was. Nobody had an idea. Why are they singing this way? Why are they wearing that? And we were just, you know, it felt like looking at like a ballet or going to a show, you know, that's what it felt like, looking at people dressed in regalia and all that. And now here I am today, I'm dancing and I'm dressed in regalia. Feels beautiful to do it. It feels nice, you know. But recollecting from when I was a teenager, it was such a huge transition for the whole community just to see that. And even still today, when I look at the children, I kind of have the same, I look at them and I know exactly what they're thinking, because I was at that stage too, where it was like, what is going on here?
I love those stories. I'm just so grateful for all the knowledge keepers in the past, and including yourself, and knowledge keepers in the present. You know, it really is a testament to how tenacious our ancestors were, you know, despite all these odds against them, to manage to keep our culture and our traditions alive. And so now, as you say, it's really a different period of time, and, you know, from being so oppressed from practicing to now we're being loud and being proud.
Exactly. And I think it's such a, like I said, nice transition. The only, I don't want to say that this digital era is a downfall. Cause for me, I have like many apps on language apps. And I look at them every now and then. Some are for recipes, Indian recipes or whatever. Some are like how to say a prayer, how to sing a certain song and so on. I go on YouTube and all this, and go on Facebook. There's what we call a living dictionary, Mi'kmaq living dictionary, but now they translated it into a language called Glusuwahanaminaw, means our language. And I am learning new language here and there, because there is a language difference, because for my generation, the 70s to the 90s, I guess, or 80s, 90s and all this, when we were going to school and all this, we had a slang, and some of the words we kind of narrowed down. And before that, it was our parents, and they narrowed it down. So, and then you have the elders who had a long word for something. And as you take a look at it through the generations, that word gets narrowed down more and more. And it's just so funny. I mean, even like today, like LOL, I mean, you know, they don't even laugh out loud anymore. They just LOL. So, you know, it's like that's where we're at. And it took me a while before, you know, somebody would say BRB. I'm like, BRB? What's that mean? You know, be right back. Why didn't you just say that? You know, so.
It reminds me, John, of Chwabanaki-ig, Wabanaki. So it's been, you know, shortened, like you said. You are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU FM. I am your co-host, Esther Ann, along with Maria Gerard. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. Today, we're talking about a return to the teachings with our guest, John Dennis. He's the cultural coordinator at the Aroostook Band of Mi'kmaqs. And we were just talking about language and LOL. LOL.
John, I was wondering, what would you want people to understand about Wabanaki or Mi'kmaq people?
Well, for me, I guess, you know, when I was in Eskasoni in Cape Breton, Nova Scotia, I only knew Mi'kmaq because that's the only ones that I really seen. I did not know of any, I know, and I seen other tribes, you know, on TV and all this, you know, like Lone Ranger and all that. And, you know, you see them and it's like, oh, they got an Indian on there, you know, and then you're looking at it. And then later on, you have TV shows and all this. And then we started raking blueberries as a teenager, even before that, you know, I was raking blueberries and people were speaking the language. And we were like, wow, they almost sound Mi'kmaq. They almost sound Mi'kmaq. You know, and we were like, I can understand almost something of what they're saying. And that's when we kind of knew that there was, you know, I'm talking about me and my siblings, because at that time, the Wabanaki culture and all this, it was not discussed. I mean, it was just mostly for our area, the Mi'kmaq, and in our schools. So we never really discussed anything about the Wabanaki until I came here. And then it's like, Penobscots, Passamaquoddies, and then Maliseets. And it's like, what? Whoa, what? Who? When? You know, so after a while, we started learning about the Wabanaki. And, you know, when we went back to school and all this, because a lot of people were like, why are we not teaching this? Why are we not teaching about the Wabanaki Confederacy? Why are we not teaching about the Wabanaki and all this? And so from there, it transitions and it opened up a lot of eyes. And like for me, when I came to Maine, I really loved hearing about the different dialects that we all have. You know, like we will say Upchichkanamnyo, Minachkanamnyo. And then for us, it's Upnamultis, you know, and it has a slight variance, but it's still the same, you know. So the language is very, it's Algonquin, but for me, it's like, it's family, you know, and that's my family, you know, that because when I see my friends, my family around here, it's like, I'm so happy to see them. I guess for me to understand about Wabanaki, for people to understand it, it's just to take a look at, you know, for being up in Presque Isle, Maine, right? I hear language and I hear people in the valley, you know, up in Fort Kent areas are speaking French. Now the French that they speak over there, and this is a very close quarter area. So you have the French in the valley, and then you have the French in New Brunswick, then you have the French in Quebec. So they're all French, but it's very different dialect. The same thing when it goes to English. The English that they speak here in Maine, yeah, you know, we always had a yeah, you know, there's no way of texting that yeah. But when you go down to Boston and Bar Harbor, Bahaba, you know, so the dialect changes, but we still understand them, you know. And for me, I find that it's not the people or it's the language, it's just the geographical location, I guess, that I don't know what it is. Might be something in the water. I'm not really sure, or salt water. Because sometimes the salt water Passamaquoddy and the freshwater Passamaquoddy. No, I'm just joking.
hey, watch it.
No. You guys speak a little different every once in a while there.
Well, and language is also evolves too, right? Mm-hmm. Like my mother used to talk about, because we say now a lot, we'll say woolly spuzzawill, which is woolly good spuzzawill, morning, good morning. So it's like trying to I think Roger Paul calls it reverse engineer the word, you know, which is, it's just how language evolves because our world changes around us too, right?
Yeah. And that's the same. I mean, we're trying to teach manners. I guess we're trying to say, you know, like for us, we never really said Willy Gisgik or Willy Iksapu, because if it's raining out, it's not really Willy Iksapu. It's, you know, it's raining. So if it's a beautiful morning, then yeah. If it's a yucky morning, you know, so it's like it's sleeting and raining and with a little bit of snow. Winnie Gisgik. Winnie is like bad, you know. So, and but you wouldn't say that, you know.
Right.
You know, you would just.
You sound just like my mother, John. That's exactly what she would say. She said we would look outside and comment on what was really happening at the time.
Yeah. And that's just it. I mean, even like us, even like for this office, we used to have people, they would answer the phone, Willy Gisgik, or Ben McMax, and it would be just downpouring outside. It's not Willy Gisgik. It's like it's downpouring outside, you know, but they didn't get it because for them, all they knew was that Willy Gisgik means good day, good morning, you know. So you're just, and a lot of people imply that, you know, this is like a salutation or something like that, you know, and that's how you would say that, you know, you would say good morning or you would say good day or good afternoon. And if it, you know, but for us, I find that we're very literal people, you know, we're very literal people when it comes to how we're using our salutations, I guess. And even like people would say New Year's. How do you say Happy New Year's? Puzu Punani. And Puzu is a handshake. And Punani is like a, you know, it's like asking for forgiveness and so on. So it's more than just a handshake. It's not just saying Happy New Year. It's more than that. It's asking for that forgiveness through the handshake and saying, I'm sorry, you know, forgive me and all this, you know, and there's more to it than just that. So even like for us, we have honor when you come to our office, we have a saying called Apjilasi. Apjilasi has become something what we call welcome. However, in researching and looking at stories, there was one story where this chief was sitting in a seat of honor, would ask the person to explain who they are, where they come from, who their parents are, and so on. And this person would sit by the door. After he had explained who he was, so the chief would say, Apjilasi, come sit closer to me. So from there, he would come sit closer and they would have an in-depth or personal conversation. So it doesn't really necessarily mean welcome. It means just like, come sit closer to where I'm at. So when it comes to, I guess, the understanding of me, Wabanaki, even like language and all this and so on, it's very complex. I mean, because we try to mimic, I feel like most of it, we try to mimic what is going on in the world today. Even like, how do you do LOL? No, we can't. And there's no LOL, you know, there's no way of emulating that. And like, you know, when I think about like, even like our Mi'kmaq people, our dialect is very different because you have the people in Gaspésia and Nisqually in the Quebec area of Gaspé. And then you have the people in New Brunswick and, you know, and then you have PEI in Nova Scotia, and then you have Newfoundland. All different dialects. When you go to when you go to the Gaspé area, their language is a little slower, and they really think out what they're saying, and it's an older dialect, I would say. When I'm speaking to some of my friends in Gaspé region, I have to really listen to what they're saying, because it's more an older dialect that they're utilizing than what we have. In Escazoni, in the Cape Breton area, we speak very fast. We speak very fast, and the times have changed where the language has changed as well. You know, because there's so many people that have changed it, and so much, and after a while, people start utilizing it in different manners. And Sisla Wadan is like, a pan, so that's a pan. And then if you want to call it a pancake, that's something else that you use with a pan. That's a bread, So it's like, it's not just adding two things together. And then you have if the people in like New Brunswick, and that's a totally different dialect in itself. There are some words that I've never heard, and when I'm speaking to them, it's like, wow, it's like, why do we have this and why do we have that? Something as simple as moose, right? For a moose, Penobscot, moose, Passamaquoddy, moose, Maliseet, moose. What do we call it? Dion. Why? I looked and I asked the elders, why do we call it Dion? Why not call it moose? And everybody was like, well, this is the sound that they make, Dion, when you're calling them. And that's the sound that they use. But another person in New Brunswick said that it's because they eat their mushkwemunk. It's a long word of saying mush. They're eating their shavings because the velvet shavings would come off. So mush was like to eat, for them to say that they're eating their shavings. And so the language, hate to be going back to the language, but that's my passion again. But it's just to say that when it comes to the people, it's there's so much knowledge that's out there, and even from different dialects, I've learned so much more about the culture. As far as what I want people to understand about us, I mean, we're still hate to say it, but we don't live in teepees anymore. That's the one thing that I get a lot. I mean, even in the state of Maine, I have kids that would email me all these questions, and they all think that we still live in these times, and we're still doing this, and so on. And I let them know that we don't live in them. We stay in them during the winter, during the summer months sometimes, but it's not really the best because it's so so mosquito-y, so Glamwijuika and, so many mosquitoes around, it's not really adequate. fine. Unless it's screened.
when you talked about the word for moose, it reminds me of in Passamaquoddy, Jeeplogin, Penobscot, Unsawagin, and Mi'kmaq is Gitbu, right? For eagle. So those are so different. I always remember them.
Gitbu, because the way he moves his head, it means Gitbuguas. That's how he moves his head from one place to the next and all this without moving his shoulders. Most of us, we move our shoulders to look, but the eagle doesn't. The eagle just uses his head just to look off to one side. So Gitbuguain is using your head without your shoulders. So that's a term. I mean, it took me a while to figure that out, and it was just right there. But I had to go to a language convention, and we were talking about animals, and even like Amalchigwich. Amalchigwich is a raccoon. Amalchigwich is he has like makeup on his eyes. Amalbachamich is another one, which is a chipmunk. He has makeup on his back. Baham, because that means back. So it's like, it's a very, it's a very descriptive language. And, you know, and it's just so fascinating how a lot of this is just so, when I teach the kids, they catch on so quick because, you know, and they just absorb so much because of how I'm introducing the language to them, and they can kind of visualize it and see, because it's a very descriptive language.
Yeah, like the word for beaver in Passamaquoddy, Gwabid, talks about the teeth. And I think the word in Penobscot talks about a different aspect of the beaver. Do you know that word, Maria?
No, I don't. I thought it was the same.
Is it the same?
I'm not sure, though.
How it's, like you said, John, descriptive, right? So it's describing different parts and how the perception is of the people, and that's how what they're going to call it. It's just,
well,
brilliant.
Gobid also means that the way they take the tree down, the tree doesn't go all the way down. It's almost like standing up, and they only bring it down sometimes. And Kutpukuwait goes, so it's like the way that a tree falls down, it's not really all the way down. It's still like still on the tree itself. It's still got that little hinge. It's not completely down. It's still stuck in that little, they only chewed like a little piece all around, but it's still, you know, still stuck together. And that Kopikawai, just like it's how the tree is still together, but it's down. It's a fascinating thing that an elder was telling us, and that's why they call them the Gobid. Also because of their teeth, but it's how they use their teeth to make that tree lay down in a certain manner.
This is always the part of language learning that fascinates me, and you said it early on that there's so much entwined with the language, you know, and it really gives you a different way of looking at things when you start breaking down the language and what different things mean. It's fascinating.
Yes. It is. It is very fascinating. You know, I'm just always just enthralled by, I mean, I'm just trying to think of an English word, but for me, it's just more than fascinating. I mean, it's just almost seems like a lifelong lesson just to learn the language. And then when you learn the language and then you break it down and you look back in history, like there's one, like the Maui-Yomi, right? Maui-Yomi is our word for gathering. And it's like we use it for powwow today. But the last word, Omi, like Maui means to gather. Omi actually means grease. Like Muin Omi would be bear grease. So I started thinking, why do we call it a gathering of grease? You know, and so it took me a long time to piece it together. But it was because our people used to gather a long time, and they would use the marrow and get the fat from the marrow, all that grease, and they would dip their meat in the grease. And it was a gathering that they would have, and all the elders would be talking, and they would dip their moose meat in that grease and eat it, because there's not a lot of oil or any kind of fat in any game meat. So you have to really kind of look for it. And from there, it really led me to, well, why do we call molasses gustiomi? You know, who's gusty? You know, so I had to go back and I asked a friend, and he said, well, gusty is, it goes back to the Portuguese trader, you know, that was named Gustafson or something like that. And it was a Portuguese word. And that was his, the word came from him, for that was his grease. Very, very fascinating. But we still use gustiomi today for molasses, and maui-yomi, you know, for powwows. But it's just, why, how do we go about using these terms, and where did they originate from?
Yeah. Thanks, John. I just wanted to remind listeners that you are listening to Dawnland Signals on WERU-FM. I am your co-host, Maria Gerard, along with Esther Ann. Dawnland Signals is a monthly talk show where we hold space for critical conversations of truth, healing, and change. And today we are talking about a return to the teachings and lots to do with language learning with cultural keeper John Dennis, who is, John, you're currently the cultural director at the Aristic Band of Mi'kmaqs, is that?
Yes, I am also the cultural coordinator, but I'm also the interim tribal historic preservation officer as well.
Oh, nice. One thing that I was liking as you were talking earlier about all the different First Nations located in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, I like that our listeners are mostly, well, I guess it can be around the world now that WERU is streaming live, but, you know, here in Maine, folks might think of the Aristic Band of Mi'kmaqs in Presque Isle and not realize that they are part of this broader confederacy of Mi'kmaqs all across New Brunswick and Nova Scotia. There's actually several tribes, right? How many are there? Do you recall off the top of your head?
I believe it was at 28 reservations in Canada altogether, from the Gaspé region in Quebec, New Brunswick, Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, and two reservations, I believe, in Newfoundland.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've done a lot of work over the years in keeping the culture and preserving the language, working with children. And
yes.
You recently got some good news, right, along these lines. Do you want to share about what's next in your future?
Yes. What's next is I will be attending MIT in September for Indigenous Language Program. It's a linguistics master's program. And from there, we've had couple of our Wabanaki elders have gone through it, like, you know, Wayne Newell, not name dropping, but it's like, for me, I respect these gentlemen, Roger Paul, Newell Louis. And, you know, I hope at some day there'll be a female coming to this. And because, you know, I want that, you know, I'm always about equality and so on. And because I just feel that, and I hope that with people, some of the Wabanaki listeners will be like, yes, I want to, you know, I want to motivate them. And I don't want to challenge you. I just want to motivate the ladies out there to really see if they can come to this. Because, you know, for me, our language is, they call that a mother tongue. You know, we learn the language from our moms. You know, that's what I feel anyway, because, you know, she's the first one that taught us how to, you know, what the words and so on. And so I try to teach the language to the moms first and foremost, even just by baby talking. It sounds funny, but the transition of baby talking to the language is very simple after a while. You know, it's just, you know, and so on. And it's just, you know, it's like, I remember one word, and everybody teased me about it for a horse was bobo, but in the language is decibel. So because the children, they don't have teeth, so they can't use the S word. They can't use some of those consonants that we have. And as a language speaker person and a teacher, I had to learn which language was one of the first languages that the children can use. They can use mom, because you don't really need teeth to say mom, you know, you just need your lips. And there's so bow in all these different languages, you know, and so on. But when it comes to dad, you need your teeth to say that. So, and that's my, as far as like helping out the people, I mean, I guess that's it. You know, I try to help them out so that they can teach their children.
That sounds fabulous. I really appreciate all that you've done over the years. I know I first met you when I was also cultural director at Penobscot Nation at the same time that you were the director in 2009. So I've had lots of opportunities for our paths to cross and language gatherings and things like that. So it's really been, it's been a lot of fun. And the people who are involved in it are just so passionate in it. So I'm really excited for you and congratulations on MIT.
Thank you.
Seems like a logical next step.
Yes. Yeah, it was a lot of work to do, but I you know, it's something that I feel that needs to be done, you know, for me to move forward and to adapt and change is to adapt with the programs and just kind of learn from the get-go on how to go about utilizing utilizing whatever that we have around us, the resources, you know, because there's so many resources that we have around us and that are really underutilized. You go to the libraries, you go to online and so on. And we have, like I said, we have so many apps on our phones and, you know, on YouTube and Facebook. So yeah, and on social media, it's just phenomenal the amount of ways that we can learn the language.
You know, this is Esther. I wanted to share a story. You talked about when you first met John, Maria. The first time I remember meeting John was when we, the ICWA work group was just starting to do the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. We were the convening group. This is just the beginnings of REACH. And we gathered in at Point Lookout in Northport. I think it was in 2009, 2010. And we were doing all these workshops, engaging the community about, you know, what would this look like? What, you know, and just wading through this thickness. And John was so clear, excuse me, he was so clear in sharing. He said, I'll never forget it. And we've quoted him over the years. You're going to open a big can of worms, he said, you know, and we really need to be mindful of taking care of people when we open this can of worms, because our people have worked hard to keep the cover on the can. And here we are opening it. And I remember you were even doing the hand motions of opening a can. And it really reinforced the lessons that we had learned leading up to the commission. And it just stating it that way and validating it, it meant so much to everybody there and made a big impact on me. So when we talk about preserving our culture, that's those values, right? You know, we talked about preserving culture in all these different ways, and the ways that we treat each other and interact with each other is at the heart of our values too. And that's what it reminds me of.
Mm. And it's hard really when your passion is so, you're so gung-ho about doing this, all this good work, and you want to move forward and you're just like, whoa, I forgot about that. And, you know, and that's just it. I mean, because that really came to me when another person was talking about what they felt like when they were talking about how, when they opened up, how they felt. And so from there, I was just thinking, wow, this is one person and we're going to be doing this to many people. Wow. Oh, well, I didn't know how to go about saying it. So I just said it how, in the John Dennis way, I guess, I just use, you know, whatever that I have in my head. And all I was thinking of was like, just a can, you know, and just like can of snakes that pop out and all these snakes, you know, are all over the place. And I don't know why I call them worms, but you know, it's just one of those things, I guess, we really need to take a look at is, you know, because in our, all of our work, we always think about what will our work look like for our community and what would it look like, you know, in the long run. But we regret, or we sometimes forget to include the person that we're interviewing or the people that we're working for. And I've seen it so many times, and it's just you know, it's like, you know, exactly. And we've gone through it, and we've had people that interview our elders and all this and so on, and then after that, where did that report go? I don't know. Nobody knows. And that's just it. So now it's just, you know, before even we ask, it's like, as community members, we say, can we get this back? Can we, you know, how are you going to be conducting this interview? Are you going to be talking about emotions? What are you What do you want to talk to our elders about? What, and so on. So because if a person is coming into your home and wants to open up this can of worms, wow, you know, that's very difficult, because now this could be a person that may be triggered, re-triggered, maybe re-traumatized. There's so many benefits or factors that go into play, you know, and it's just, and you're talking not just one home, you're talking about a community. And so it has a huge impact. And, you know, our people have gone through a lot, and we've persevered. I have this, on my computer, this thing that I found on Facebook, and it was a picture. And it says, all that your ancestors had to go through for you to be here, and you doubt yourself. How dare you? You come from a legacy of survival that is to never be questioned. So for me, I always, when I look at my screen, I see this. And when I'm feeling bad about myself, I'm like, I'm a tree. They tried to bury me, but they didn't realize I was a seed. You know, that was a something, a proverb, or a person came up with that quote. And for me, it's like, that's our ancestors. That's our elders. We've persevered through all of this, but at the same time, we hold on to that trauma, I know you guys have talked about this before, the intergenerational trauma, you know? And it's difficult. It's difficult because it's nothing that just happened a long time ago. It's been happening. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We also always try to remember to talk about the intergenerational strength, and especially that sense of joy and happiness and having fun and laughing. I mean, I've met a lot of people, different people in my life, and I've never encountered anything like Indian humor that we have. I could be biased.
No, I think it's true. Absolutely.
There are a lot of pun masters out there, so dad jokes galore. I mean, I love dad jokes, so, but I'm just biased.
I do realize that I do notice that when there's a group of speakers around, there's almost always a lot of laughter. So I think there is that joy that's also embedded into our language as well.
Exactly. So, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
No, I was going to say that, you know, we tease each other and so on. And you know, even like listening to elders, and it was called a conference called Illinois-Weaseltonetch, and it means to speak our language. And when I was just sitting there, these elderly women, they're talking about how their coffee got mixed up at a coffee shop, and somebody had their coffee and you have mine and that one. And they were just laughing. And it was just a simple mix up, but those ladies were just laughing so much because it was just so funny, because no, I have your coffee, you have mine, and so on. And it's just, you know, and it's like, it's just something. And everybody in the room was just laughing. These were like four ladies that went to a coffee shop, and they came back and they had the whole room laughing like 15, 20 minutes. So, and over just something as simple as that. And it just shows you, you know, when there's joy with the language and so on, that, you know, it's just, there's no words to explain how it feels like to be with like-minded individuals and to speak the same language and so on, and to be with one another instead of just being in the same room.
And some of the stories, when you hear them translated into English, they're not half as funny as they are when you hear them in the language, when you understand what they're saying.
Exactly. Yeah. And some of them you don't want to repeat anyway. So.
So, John, we have just about 4 minutes left before the end of our program. And you had talked about Maui-Omi, and I just wanted to circle back to that, your annual gathering. Will that be held this year? And if so, when and where?
So we had a huge discussion with the Maui-Omi committee about holding it this year. Last year we had postponed it. We had canceled because of COVID, but this year we are thinking of that, opening it up. A lot of the local areas around us are opening up their events. So we feel that it would be because a lot of us have had our vaccinations, our elders and so on. And so we feel that this gathering, people need it. They need to heal. They need to get out. They need to laugh. They need to dance. They need to hear the songs and the stories and so on. As silly as it may sound, so, you know, just some of the simple stories that we share, just, you know, enough to it's that kind of humor that it makes you spit out your coffee all over the place while you're taking a sip. You know, that's the kind of humor that's out there. And so for me, it's like that Maui Omi is medicine. You know, that our gatherings are medicine, and
absolutely,
and so on. And so our gatherings are typically usually in the third weekend of August, but because we have a conflict with two other powwows in Canada, we decided to open it on the fourth weekend of August instead, so that we don't have that conflict. We're trying to minimize where people are going, because if there's three powwows going on at the same weekend, it makes it very difficult for everybody to try to attend at least one, because you want to attend at least one at all. And when you have people spread out like that, it makes it difficult. And, you know, for me, I think about the drummers and the dancers and the vendors, you know, and so on. And most importantly, our elders and the children, because for me, it's like for me to see the children out there laughing and playing and just running around, you know, and when it gets down to business, they're quiet. You know, they learn from us, the adults and the elders. They learn from us, and we tell them, you know, be quiet. They're saying a prayer and so on, and hearing the elders laugh is just, you know, that's medicine. I mean, for me, when I hear them laughing, I don't know what they're laughing at, but I'm like smiling because it's such a huge, like I said, it's just huge medicine to hear that laughter, that boisterous laughter that they have, especially the women. They just will laugh, and then hit each other and laugh and so on. And, you know, and not hit each other in a mean kind of way. That's why I don't really sit next to them, because you see, I'm the one that's making them laugh, and then they're hitting me just to stop it. So yeah,
I love that. So absolutely. So for some good medicine, the Mi'kmaq Maui Omi will be August 28th and 29th at Presque Isle, and I'm sure that folks will be sure to see you there, right?
Yeah, it'll actually be in Caribou, 214 Doyle Road. It's in Spruce Haven. So that's where we always have. It's a nice camping area off the road, so you don't have traffic and so on. So it's beautiful.
Very nice. Well, unfortunately, our time has come to a close here on Dawnland Signals. We're so grateful for you joining us today, John, and keep up the great work. I love hearing all that you are doing. So thank you for joining us, John. Thank you to the listeners for joining us on Dawnland Signals. Thank you to the volunteer technician, Jeffrey Hotchkiss, for his assistance and support. Be sure to join us every third Thursday of the month for Dawnland Signals and more conversations of truth, healing, and change.
Inatchkanamyo. Upchit.
Upchit.